the current of breath inward. Turning your awareness inward, the senses inward, and any coming and going, any sounds from outside to the next room, just hear them as sacred sound, pure energy. If they arise or appear as a distraction, let that take you deeper into your concentration and contemplation. Reach out and touch each other's hands. Feel the light and the life of each being in a circle, connected to the life and the light of the fabric of the universe. Invoke the presence of the Master, Saints, and Prophets. We invoke the presence of Hazrat Naik Khan as we say the Sufi invocation.
Towards the One, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being, united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance.
Bless you. Keep attuned to the breath. Hold the concentration, the vibrations that were created from the last class here and just stay very concentrated. You know, there's the tendency, sometimes we feel we can't contain the energy, and so there we kind of reduce to fidgeting or a lot of talking or, a lot of hugging sometimes can also dissipate that energy. It's okay to maintain it and contain it, to let it be the agent for transformation. It's always so good to watch the mind. Is the mind grasping at the door to see who's coming in? If the mind does that, the mind has left its home. Stay centered in the breath. And very concentrated. Once again, reach out and touch the person on your left and your right. Feeling the touch of the beloved moving through this person. And through this circle. Say the Sufi invocation again. Towards the one,
the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being, united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of God.
Gently and very slowly, let your hands move as down the fingers of the individual next to you, fingertips to fingertips, yet keeping the connection to this and all beings. So for this session, what I would like to do is share with you a reading that was delivered at summer school. Yesterday we had the delivery of the reading called The Path of Initiation, and today I'd like to read, I'd actually like to try to get through two papers, but I don't want to push it and oversaturate you or the space, but we'll see how it goes. The one... I'm going to begin by the sharing of the paper on mysticism. And again, these are teachings as given by Hazrat Anayat Khan. And one of the things that was done at summer school this year in Holland was Murshid Hidayat gave a wazifa, a sacred phrase, prior to the reading of each sacred reading. And the wazifa, or sacred word that was given prior to the reading of this paper, was Alim, A-L-I-M, but pronounced A-L-E-E-M, Alim. As I mentioned yesterday, in Arabic writing, it's a consonant-based written language where the vowels are applied. But even in Quranic verse, the old Qurans had no vowel markings. And the vowel markings are those aspects that actually give meaning. So without the vowel markings, verses become very open to interpretation, which is very beautiful, and I like to share that because that's significant for you to know. I also like to make it very clear that at least within the Sufi movement, Sufism is not defined nor limited in a context of Islam. Not at all. Sufism is defined as a path of spiritual liberty that honors all religions. And if you look categorically up within the listings, it is not listed amongst the Islamic Sufi orders. There are some that are, but universal Sufism of a Nayat Khan is not. I think there can be confusion because we do use the Arabic language from time to time, but we also use the Persian and Hindu and Sanskrit and Tibetan and Hebrew and many other languages. And Nayat Khan said if it could be described in any way, it would be called the religion of the heart, not the mystical aspect of Islam. The religion of the heart. And again, you know, what happened in the last afternoon session, the best laid plans, so I feel compelled to share this a little bit before I read the Sufi reading, the sacred reading of mysticism and doing the practice of Aleem, to share this paper that was delivered by Murshid Hidayat and Nayat Khan at summer school this year. And these are various extracts from the message lectures of Hazrat Nayat Khan, his father. And it may help define for those. I'm very concerned about you sitting on the cold pavement. I prefer for you to have something under your
coat.
Okay. I just, please don't, if you get cool, it's not, it's just not good for you. And we have blankets and all kinds of things that you can sit on. I want you to be comfortable and also healthy. Okay. The Sufi message is a message of spiritual liberty, and therefore cannot be confined to one type of presentation. Just as the glowing light of the sun cannot be concentrated into one single ray, the Sufi message, which is a world message, is an appeal to harmonize with all beliefs without forming an exclusive community, but rather a nucleus holding us together in contemplation and service to God. Therefore, the Sufi message is the message of the heart, and there are as many rays of the message as there are hearts reflecting its light. And the more clearly one is able to reflect the light of the message, the more conscious one becomes of all aspects of its radiance. The religion of the heart, which is experienced without any religious obligations, is one wherein the unity of religious ideals is followed unconditionally in search of truth, without going astray. When following the followers of the great religious reformers, whose messages have been altered through the centuries by those who confuse mysticism and fanaticism. In Sufism, there's no place for comparisons or preferences. All messengers are regarded with the same respect, and their messages are worshipped with the same veneration. They were bringers of new impulses of the divine message, which the multitude uses as toys with play and the imposters use in power games. This explains why a Sufi restrains from unnecessary arguments and critics regarding the beliefs of others, as addressed yesterday. In that organization, we should not consider all the different distinctions which appear as being higher or lower grades. We should consider them as being indications related to greater or smaller responsibilities. It has been meant from above that some have been given these responsibilities in order to lead the movement throughout the world. So here he's talking about initiatic levels and, you know, discouraging any kind of comparison, really. You know, it doesn't have to do with someone's more realized or less realized. For whatever reason, their dharmic path is to be more responsible. They're just given that greater responsibility. In reality, every murid, every student is a representative, and every murid communicates some aspect of the message. Therefore, every murid is responsible for the dignity of the movement, and shall become conscious of this more and more while working for the message. Therefore, we must not think that the humblest amongst us, the most modest amongst us, is not spiritual. Perhaps that person is the most spiritual. How do we know? We, the servants of the Sufi message, who have joined together hand in hand, must not for one moment doubt how a handful of workers will be able to fulfill the service for which they are called, keeping in mind that whatever the message of God has been given to the world, its central theme and great ideal has always been the brotherhood and sisterhood of humanity. Our confidence and trust in the Sufi message must strengthen us to stand firm in the service of God and humanity. And we should never let ourselves become discouraged by the lack of response, which everyone experiences at some time or other in this limited world. Now, our difficulties in spreading the message are numberless. Very often our methods within our same movement may be seen to be different, and the difficulties of interpretation shall always remain as long as the true ideal is not clearly understood. This is again why not discussing it unless one understands it very well. In the eyes of God, no one is superior, No one is inferior. We are all equal. We all stand equal before God. Even the humblest amongst us, even the one who is full of faults and errors, we all stand before God with our love for one another as brothers and sisters. The ideal evoked in the esoteric school of the Sufi movement, and again we talked about that yesterday, that's the initiatic chain that one through initiation enters. The ideal, and he said, remember, it's not for everyone. The ideal evoked in the esoteric school of the Sufi movement is to discover the divine in all souls while following onwards on the path with patience and perseverance, proving thereby to be worthy of the trust received. It went on to say, the universal worship, the traditional universal worship, not an alteration of it, of which we rarely see here, but the traditional universal worship, I should say that there was a variation of that that took place this morning, which I think is called the universal celebration or something else. But the universal worship, this is an icon's words, the prayers Psalm, Salat, and Khatun have an inner significance. These prayers are not only offered as praise to God or as a thanksgiving, but they are meant to draw one nearer, closer to the divine being, which is the mission of the Sufi message today. Therefore, it is most essential to keep the words of these prayers intact and unchanged, so that they may be given to future generations in an authentic form and in an uncorrupted way. There should be no attempt made by adding anything to the prayers of universal worship, or to take anything out of them, with the idea of creating beauty. With this understanding, one shall benefit fully from these prayers. If everyone makes a choice of the words of the prayers, in the end, the prayers shall be quite different prayers. These prayers are too sacred to touch because they are not from a human brain. They have been poured out from above. As many times as one repeats them, these prayers increase inspiration and power. And the more one repeats them, the more one is blessed. The greatest blessing in the prayers is that they may help one come closer and closer to God, which is the seeking of every soul. The purpose of Salat. One can see the beauty of the prayer Salat. To the beauty of the rose with so many petals, one flower and so many petals. Every name repeated in Salat is like a petal of one and the same flower. Allow us to recognize thee as Rama, as Krishna, as Shiva, as Buddha. Let us know thee as Abraham, as Solomon, as Zarathustra, as Moses, as Jesus, and many other names and forms known and unknown to the world. Those are the words he's speaking of here. The purpose of Khatun, the third prayer, is an answer to the need of today. which is to bring the divided sections of humanity together in the realization of truth. This is the principal aim of the Sufi message. God shall take care of the message, and we few who are brought together by Providence to work hand in hand are the guardians of this divine message. And it is our sacred duty to cradle it with selfless love and unshakable faith in the ever-present spirit of guidance. Summer school this year. Summer school began there in Holland in 1922. First summer school, Osram and Icon. We're still meeting there. Are there any questions about what was read or any comments?
Is there a particular order for the two prayers, Salat and Khartoum? I mean, is one opening and closing? Or?
Yes, there are actually three prayers, and one of them is not addressed. The first prayer of the day is called Psalm, and the second prayer of the day is called Salat, and the third prayer of the day is called Khartoum. And the first prayer of the day, as Hazrat Anayat Khan gives it, recommends that prayer is said, you know, everything is related to the natural cycles and rhythms of nature, and so he prescribed the time at 5:55 in the morning, and then the salat is done at noon. So one is sort of the bringing of the light, you know, that being in India, the, you know, how we would chant the light into being in the morning and also in the evening. The light goes down, and so this is also the cycle, you see. And then when the sun is high at its zenith is when the noonday day prayers begun at 11:55, and it's said that the prescribed time for the evening prayer is 5:55. The sun is starting to set. And it's this cycle.
It was announced from the conch.
It's announced at the ringing of the heart.
With a conch.
Here it's not done.
No, but I mean, is that traditional, like in India, the conch is auspicious?
Well, form of Sufism was brought to the West, actually, and took root in, at first brought to America in 1910. So there is no, in fact, if you read some of Anayat Khan's teachings, he makes a very clear distinction that the message isn't of the East or of the West, it's a message of humanity. And so, in a way, he broke with some of those traditions purposefully so that people did not get confused. It was a, sort of a new era, you might say, where it's not about Anayat Khanism, and there's even been some discussion whether it should be called Sufism, because there's so many connotations with that. But it was the message that was being birthed to unite humanity, to not to become Sufis. It was never the objective, but to see the beauty of each religious path and to develop a respect for that. Not that anyone should become something else, but that it, in a way, to me, Sufism is almost more, I feel in some ways, almost more of a social movement than a religious movement, because it has that element of uniting humanity and opening up in greater understanding to each other, to feel a sympathy and a harmony. And I would be willing to bet that all of you in this room have probably experienced a number of different traditions, and if you have and you've gone deeply into those, you start to come into that awareness, although things may be done differently, said differently, whatever, that at the root there's, you know, it's like His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, the basis of all religion is to have a kind and good heart, and not to hurt people, to help them if you can, but at least don't hurt them. You know, love thy neighbor as thyself. Do unto others as you wish them to do unto you. That's sort of the premise of all the different religions. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, more than. The one thing here that is really gripping me is that this is the only teaching by a holy man that is about inclusion and not exclusion. Whereas all other religions and practices are based on exclusion. That following that path is exclusive to that teacher. So it's beautiful. And then when I look at his photograph, there's a likeness of the Christ. The Christ portraits that we've seen since we were little children.
And there are other photos. I mean, this one definitely has that Christ consciousness. There are times where you can feel kind of Abraham or Moses coming through. I mean, he definitely had that, you know, you could see that he was invoking those different
presence. But he also has a resemblance to Yogananda.
Yeah, that's right. Those illuminated beings, there's some sort of an imprint that comes forward, or radiance that we see. And it's a commonness. Thank you.
In the morning prayer, the psalm, I would assume that doing elemental breaths prior to prayer would help kind of tune you.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, getting tuned to the breaths and then coming forth through the prayers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the movements of the prayers, which I find very helpful.
Exactly.
You know, it was fun today because I've been practicing that. When Zahir was leading it, you know, I was like, where are those movements? That was fun.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder also about the other paths, you know, other paths, how lightly one can take them. You know, one can get a snippet, because that's what I did. Heavy chunk from Buddhism, a snippet from the Upanishads, and then, you know, coming over here to Jesus and coming over here. And is that as healthy as going kind of more, you know, learning as much as you can from all the traditions? That's the question. I don't know.
It's also said that, I mean, I believe that those things are part of the path of initiation, whether one's on an initiatic path or, you know, life is an initiatic path. And I feel that that's part of the awakening of one's heart. And it's a search, it's a journey. At the same time, I think it is important when one feels like they've settled on something to make a deep abiding commitment to that and to kind of stick with it. It's, you know, they've likened it to drilling for water or oil. You know, if you just keep in the same place, eventually you're gonna drill through and find some sort of gold there. But if you dig just a little bit here and a little bit there and a little bit here and a little bit there, you know, you just end up with a lot of little shallow holes.
Mm-hmm.
My teacher used to say, fishing in every pond.
Mm-hmm.
You'll never realize the goal.
And the truth is, really and truly, if you've ever had the opportunity to be in a room with people that are rather advanced and realized in their paths, they may be coming from things at a very different direction, but fundamentally they agree. So in a way, if one's studying something very deeply, it's like a key that can open all the doors. They say that in Tibetan Buddhism, which of course is well known for its, you know, multiplicity and pantheon of various deities, and it's kind of like, where do you begin? But the truth is, one devoted practice to one meditational deity, Yidam, that will open all the doors to everything. And I, for one, and I've said it many times to many of you, I believe the prayers and the breath do that.
My professor is, Zen is his specialty, but he talks about Eastern religions in terms of the hologram. And so anything can be a holographic entrance point, and that's how he looks at Hinduism or whatever. And so I just thought that was a nice...
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, it's kind of like DNA or something, you know,
yeah.
Or fractal. Every part's related to everything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Like that. Anything else?
I just have one. This is a technical question.
Yes.
Imrat, as I had come.
Hazarat. Hazarat, by the way, is an honorific term that is given to someone after their passing.
Oh.
It's not a name, it's a term. And it means, it's a referential term. So we wouldn't call someone Hazarat that's living. That name comes afterwards. It's like beloved teacher, you know, but it's, his name was Anayat Khan, but we call him Hazrat Anayat Khan. Yeah. I'm sorry, I wanted to make sure you knew.
That's good.
And understood.
So, is he the originator of the lineage? In other words, this teacher, Pir Vilayat. And are there others who descended from him, or are they simply initiates of his teaching who took followers or disciples of in his teachings? Or is every Sufi master descended from him in succession?
No, there are many different traditions from many parts of the world. Many. And, so that... Again, his path came through this stream of from India. Now, to answer the question about modern Sufism in America, Hazrat Anayat Khan had two sons. One was Vilayat, and one was Hidayat. He also had two female children. One was Nuranisa and one was Clarinisa. Nuranisa's the, you know, she was the great martyr of, very decorated martyr of World War II. She was the last surviving member over the German border of the French resistance and met with a very horrific fate at the hands of the Nazis. She's been highly decorated by the French government. Now they're making lots of books and lots of movies. The Indian government also is decorating her with her heroic acts. Vilayat was the eldest son. Hidayat was the third child, so Nuranisa oldest, Vilayat, Hidayat, Clarinisa, who's still alive in Germany. Hidayat is also still alive. Pir Vilayat, as you probably know, has passed. His son is Zia. Now, this was not intended at all as the lesson, but there was the mainstream came through what was known as the Sufi movement and still is. Sufi movement. Its headquarters is in Holland. Vilayat at one point split from the organization. It was really a matter of a family issue. And he came to America. In 1910, I said, Hazrat Mai Khan came to America and established Sufism. He was in San Francisco and traveled throughout the United States. His main students held that concentration, primarily in San Francisco. Murshid Samuel Lewis, who you hear a lot of, who was the originator of the dance, had met Hazrat Inayat Khan and became a student of the disciples of Hazrat Inayat Khan in the Sufi movement.
Not of Inayat Khan himself, but through a lineage.
Right, but he had met Inayat Khan.
Mm-hmm.
So, at one point, there was to be a succession, meaning that the existing current head of the movement in San Francisco, this is years ago, was to sort of give the mantle, so to speak, to someone else, and there was a rift. You know, this happens.
Oh gosh, yes. It's
and so, because of that rift, Samuel Lewis left that organization. He went to Pakistan. He studied with the sheikh there, Qutbuddin Bakhtiar Khaki, and that is where he received his lineage and aligned with that. That became the Sufi Rouhaniyat tradition. Is everyone following me so far? When Vilayat left Europe, he came to America and aligned with Sam. They were operating as one group. And you will hear both Sam, or read, both Sam and Vilayat, I heard it with my own ears from Pir Vilayat, that they were like the sun and the moon, the mother and the father. Then again, there was a little friction that arose. And there was another split. And then one became the Sufi Rouhaniyat and one became the Sufi order. All the while, the Sufi movement's still alive in Europe and functioning. So this is how these organizations came into being. And they all have their different fragrance and their different atmosphere and their different esoteric line of transmission. And that's really wonderful. Now, further, what happened in Europe, there were a few other splits, and there became what's called the Sufi Way. Because you see, every time the leader either steps down or passes away, there's always this thing that happens. Mm-hmm. And people, this is why last I was telling you about the formation of the Pir and Murshid Council. Murshid Hidayat is trying to avoid all that by saying we want to have a success, not a succession of leadership, but a continuation of leadership. This is why this whole, what he's trying to create with the Pir and Murshid Council is so brilliant, because it's a group of people, not a singular person. You've been informed of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the intention that, looking ahead.
I had a question about lineage, the Sicilia.
Yeah.
I've seen in the Rouhaniyat where they list, the lineage traced back to Muhammad, but that isn't part of the Sufi movement, is it? Am I correct about that? I've never heard any.
No. And in fact, if you want to get the hairs on Hidayat's neck, you start talking about the Chistis and that Sicilia, because he is. In fact, it's in one of the Gothicas. And if anyone's interested, I have it digitally. But it quotes in there. This is Inayat Khan speaking. I owe everything to my teachers in the Chistia school. But the account has been paid in full, and the account is now closed. This is not a tradition from that past. This is a new tradition moving forward. So he made a split, and you probably know, Merchant of Diet's probably told you, and when you see the film of the cornerstone of the Universal being laid in Suren, underneath that cornerstone was placed that paper, his certificate from the Chistia School, along with coins and other precious artifacts. It was put under the cornerstone. And when Hadayat asked one of the brothers of Anayat Khan, because Anayat Khan then left right after that to go to India and never returned, he passed away there. But he asked Murshid Ali, he said, why? Because he was known to be one of the very esoteric, you know, he was the healer and very esoteric in his knowledge. And he said, why would my father place that precious paper in the ground like that? And he said, in India, when we have things of this nature and we don't want to throw them in the trash, and sometimes we don't even want to burn them because it's intense, he said, we offer it to the earth so it can just disintegrate. And so there was a reason for that. And that's, you know, it's interesting, if people really want to know, it's kind of important to know that. To have that clarity around what, we have these wonderful camps where these different organizations actually come together and function harmoniously, yet they are separate organizations with their own unique sort of esoteric transmission that come from different, you know, orientations.
And I notice also, we say Katoom a lot here, I mean, relatively. And I don't recall hearing it much at all in Europe. And they say, you know, at least at the summer school, the Saum and Salat is... I was just wondering about that.
The Saum and the Salat, Anayat Khan, in some of the collective interviews, he's put a lot of emphasis on those two prayers. He refers to them as the two pillars of the Sufi message. And so there is a great deal of emphasis put on that, those two prayers. Yeah.
Katoom seems a little Western.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A way of bringing everybody in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I love it. I've shared it with people.
Yeah, it's a beautiful prayer as well.
And they go, wow, yeah, I can see it. Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you go to Holland...
Yes.
The summer camp that you're referring to, when you go to Holland, that is the purest essential root of Anayat Khan's teaching there. That is the movement.
Well, I don't want to say anything that could be upsetting to anybody in terms of what's pure and what's not pure. I've been around for a long time. I have searched for a very long time to feel what I felt was that real clear ringing of the bell. And for me, that's what it feels like. And it has been the tradition that has kept, you know, they've really kind of kept that. They have the archives, they, you know, keep the articles that were originally developed. They, you know, so they really they feel that it is their dharmic responsibility to maintain the integrity, because here we are, it's going to be 100 years since he came in 2010, it's going to be 100 years since Anayat Khan came to the West. Think about that. And if they've been able to maintain that for 100 years. But we all know what's happened to so many of the other traditions after 100, 200, 300 years. And that's why they take that task as being very sacred, to not alter things or mix, match them up or get confused about that lineage and tradition.
I've seen that he actually left from California and returned to India before he left his body.
He lived in Europe a good many years.
In what?
Europe.
But you said he came to California.
And then he went back and he was in Europe.
In Europe, okay.
Yeah, and he lived in Russia, he lived in England, he lived in France, he spent time in Switzerland, but when he left for India, he left from France in 1927. He passed away on February 5th, 1927. And the family was there in France, outside of Paris.
And the dances that we do, the universal dances of peace, where did that fit into the program or puzzle or history?
When Hazara the Night Khan first came to America, he came to he and his brothers and a cousin came as musicians. They were great musicians, and their grandfather had established kind of the Royal Academy of Music in India, and he was the first one to make musical notation to Indian music. So they came to America through the music, and there was a great dancer at the time who had met them in Europe. And her name was Isadora Duncan.
Oh, yes.
And she was very interested in Oriental matters. So she collaborated with them to develop these dances, and they played for her. And that's why they were in California. Mm-hmm. Now, Isadora Duncan was the teacher of Ruth St. Denis. And Ruth St. Denis and Samuel Lewis knew each other. And so they had started to conceive of some way of practicing that incorporated movement. My understanding is that originally that was a seated practice of sort of moving. Then Murshid Samuel Lewis traveled to India. And near the Taj Mahal is a beautiful site of a Sufi saint called Salim Chisti. And he is known as kind of the saint that's prayed to when women want to conceive and, you know, things like that. But people have the tendency to go there. They say that he was a great Sufi. He had, so that people pay great reverence to him. And it is, you know, honestly, I can't even remember who told me this. But I think it might have been Pir Vilayat, but I remember someone told me that it was at the, it might even also be in some of Sam's papers. At one point when Murshid Moinuddin Jablonski was alive, I was spending a little time in California, and he gave me the great gift of opening Murshid Samuel's office, and gave me it's like, here's the photocopy, or here's the papers. And it was like these onion skin, like, you know, all the stuff that Murshid Wali Ali had typed. And I copied it, so I have, like, you know, this stuff. So I read a lot of this stuff. That's not stuff, it's beautiful teachings, and his sharing and practices and commentary on Hazara Night Khan's, you know, teachings and so forth. So anyway, but the point is that at that site, it is said that at the doorway there of that darga, that sacred site, that grave, you might say, is where he received the inspiration for the dances. And it was also synchronistic with the 1960s. The Vietnam War was happening, and he felt that it was very important for a number of things to happen. To create something that was a contradiction to the military march. So he wanted to create something that was rhythmic and fluid and beautiful, and instead of in linear formation in circles, so there were esoteric reasons. And and this was an evolution of the work that he had done with Ruth St. Denis. And also, you know, that's when Haight-Ashbury was happening. You know, that was like a free state. LSD was being spread around. He saw kids there. You know, he was worried about them. And he thought this was, you know, kind of a way to gather them into his basket. You know, he came from money. You probably know that. I think he was one of the Rothschilds. So he had money, and he created this center where he could, is that right?
I think it was Levi Strauss.
Levi Strauss, okay. His mother might have been a Rothschild.
Maybe.
Yeah. So then he took them in and thought, you know, they were all dancing and doing everything anyway, so it's like, I'm never going to get them to sit and meditate, but I probably could get them to hold circles and run around in a circle. And so they, you know, he had been inspired to do this, and then this is how the dances started.
Yeah. Mm. Well, I love the dances, and I was thinking at first, if I might comment for a moment, what a wonderful glue for the community to come to this camp and have dances twice a day, and everyone who wants to be there, which is the vast majority of people here, at the dance, to be able to make eye contact with everyone, to be able to touch everyone, to sing and chant with everyone, is so wonderful, you know. And now I'm finding that I love the classroom work and the studying I'm doing and everything. And the dances added to that. It's like taking chemistry or something.
Yeah.
And here I learn the concepts,
yeah,
the ideas, the teachings, the things like that. But the dances are like the lab for me on, am I feeling that unity?
Mm-hmm.
Am I getting past the shell? And
and,
you know, does my mind wander or do I meditate?
Yeah.
Is this drawing me closer to God and things like that? Mm-hmm. So I appreciate them so much.
Yeah. Thank you.
So Sammy Lewis was American.
Mm-hmm.
Ruth St. Denis, was she British or French?
No.
And
I think she's American.
They were both Americans?
Yeah, I think he's a Dora Duncan, spent a lot of time in Europe, but they were Americans.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Martha Graham was, she was studied with Ruth St. Denis, so that lineage, you know, and then
Margot Fonfain.
Merce Cunningham studied with, you know,
yeah,
it's like I'm very interested in the dance lineage, too. But,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But then after Isadora Duncan was the next icon was Margot Fonfain, wasn't she? Back in the 30s or something, but she was from Europe.
Mm.
So
I guess I couldn't say. In this more spiritual lineage, this
yes.
is the lineage we're speaking of.
Yeah. It's amazing that those two linked up.
Mm-hmm.
In that.
And I had the great good fortune of one of Pierre Vilayet's senior students, Arifa Miller, studied with Ruth St. Denis. And I met her when she was in her 70s, and we became we spent a lot of time together,
mm-hmm.
but it was wonderful being with her and her reminiscences of that time with Ruth St. Denis. And, you know, she was a very deep student, but very involved in movement. Like, she put the invocation to the salutations to the sun. I still do that every day. You know, she taught me how to do that. She was... Mm-hmm. She loved movement and being in her body. I think only Karima Gita had the opportunity to meet her. From you all around here, but she came to our house and we worked on a project with her, for Pierre Vilayet, Arifa Miller, and I did. It's been a blessed life.
If you ever go to India, go to that. Go to Fatehpur Sikri. Is where the tomb is. It's an amazing place. It really is.
I've probably been to India more than 20 times,
yeah,
and I have no desire. I would like to see Salim Chisti's tomb, although I feel I've already been there somehow inwardly, but I really have no interest in going to the Taj Mahal. I've never.
Yeah.
Just bypass that.
Go to the tomb of Salim Chisti.
Would you like to hear this paper on mysticism?
Yes.
Yes.
It may surprise you. First, let's do this practice, Aleen. Aleen. Aleen, if it could be interpreted in a very brief way, it's the all-knowing. The knower of all. One that has great insight and great wisdom into all circumstances. Aleen. the concentration when doing the Mazifa, is it the center of the forehead? If one so wish, one could wish, imagine a white star there of illumination. We'll say the Wazifa 101 times, which is done traditionally. The first 34 we'll say aloud with the prefix Yah, meaning, oh dear one. Then we drop the Yah and we will whisper, Ali, Ali, Ali. It's a more intimate expression and experience of this sacred name. And then the last 33 will just be on the breath, invoking and tuning to that quality, and then we'll have the reading. The Elim is the all-knowing one, the wise, the wisdom. It's our wisdom being, our wisdom mind. Yummy, yummy, yummy. Again, these are the teachings of Hazrat Anayat Khan. This is from a lecture of his, the title of which is called Mysticism. I would like to say a few words on what we call mysticism. Sound effects. Thank you. Is it whiteboard? It sounds like metal, sheet metal. I would like to say a few words on what we call mysticism. Mysticism is a means to an end. Mysticism is not the goal, but through it, one arrives at the goal. If you ask me, what is Sufism? Is it a philosophy or is it mysticism? The answer is that it is both. And today, I'd like to speak on the mystic side of Sufism. The mystic side of Sufism may be recognized as seeing and hearing. To see further than one sees. To hear keener than one hears other words. To see that which the eyes cannot see. To hear that which the ears cannot hear. This experience brings one to the realization to see without eyes, to hear without ears. No doubt, to the mystic, seeing and hearing, these two words have a different meaning. When we say seeing, we mean seeing through the eyes. When we say hearing, we mean hearing through the ears. But to the mystic, seeing is not only through the eyes, nor is hearing only hearing through the ears. It is seeing even without eyes, and hearing even without ears. In English, there exists the word seer, which means someone who can see as well as with or without eyes. When the question arises, if there is such a thing, if there is such a hearing and seeing, would not every soul be most happy to attain this? For it would be just like having wings to fly. Who would not? Everyone. And if this is possible, if there is this possibility of seeing and hearing, why is not everybody seeking after it? The reason is that not everybody believes it. Although it can only be attained by belief and never without it. Therefore, it is something that every soul seeks after, yet about which every soul doubts. Even if the soul believes, the question is whether one has enough patience to go through with it. And patience is required because a certain preparation is necessary in order to hear and see. If everyone would like to see and hear, but if a person were open to it, would he be strong enough to endure the disadvantage? For instance, what would happen if mankind, ready as it is to criticize its fellow men, could still see more faults in them? A man who is absorbed in life's interest, if he sees a terrible thing coming upon him, upon his dear ones, will he be able to endure this? If a person who is apt to pass on one's secrets to another knew through this power the secrets of his fellow men, what terrible things could he do with it? A person who is affectionate, afraid of any harm or hurt touching their dear ones, if he saw it coming, his nerves would be shattered to pieces. Thus we see that there is a possibility of seeing and hearing in every soul, and that every soul would be most delighted to attain this power. but at the same time, that not every soul is ready to have it, nor that it would be good for every soul to possess it. If there's a secret in mysticism, there is only one. Before a person has developed his outlook, he must not hear, he must not see. Therefore, it is not to make one see and hear, but to change one's outlook that the teacher gives initiation. But when the pupil says, "I come to see and hear," the teacher says, "You wait." I will tell you my own experiences. Before I started looking for my teacher, the faculty of seeing was being developed in me. It is this which gave the desire to seek for a teacher. For the teacher can give the explanation of life. I did not tell my teacher about this faculty, for I was too impressed, too respectful to speak of what I could see and hear. But one day, after having been with my teacher for some time, I ventured to speak about it. And what was his answer? "I am sorry." I was expecting a word of encouragement. But he added, "It is not seeing or hearing. It is to acknowledge it that hinders one's progress." In reality, the gift of seeing and hearing is a gift from the divine being. The one who has this power is entrusted with the secret of life. It should be understood that at the time when this seeing and hearing begins, an initiation is given, and man becomes responsible for the secrets revealed to him. Besides, if a man was not prepared, if he had not reached a certain point, what would be the benefit? Now one might think, what kind of preparation is needed? The answer is a moral preparation. But not in the sense that we understand in everyday life the word moral. What we understand is selfish, because we judge another according to our law instead of considering him according to his law. According to the Sufi idea, moral is a different thing, especially in regard to this preparation. It is a consideration of the law of friendship, of the relationship of one's elders or superiors or those who are younger or inferior. Although it is a simple thing to consider friendship, it is the most difficult to practice. If we live a life of friendliness, there's nothing better we can live for. And if one knows the principle of friendship, one does not need the moral of the world. If instead of his own profit and laws, man considers the profit and laws of another, then he begins to see his soul. But as long as he sees the other as a separate being, different from himself, he will see him wrongly. Therefore, what Sufism offers is the faculty of becoming acquainted with these ideas. After this acquaintance, naturally the soul unfolds. And as a natural consequence of the soul's unfoldment, one gradually hears more and more. You see, sometimes the appearance of things can be very deceiving, and also we know words can be very deceiving. So there is a way in which one can penetrate through all that. That's the aspect of Aleem. Ibn Arabi used to say, seek to know, to understand that which transpires behind that which appears. That's why you hear me say, and I'll say it again and again, till it's very clearly understood, things are very rarely as they appear. And there's a great quote that I wish I could recall in this moment. Somebody in the room may know it, about Anayat Khan talking about this, how this is, you know, how does one see and hear these things and know these things and not become so shattered? And how does one maintain? I mean, he asked these questions. There's a beautiful quote. I kind of have it post-noted on my post-it notes digitally in my computer. But he talks about how does one see and hear all these things and not become disturbed by these influences mm-hmm. and circumstances and retain dignity and nobility. It's like being a great lighthouse. Everything crashing, but still radiating, shining light. Mm-hmm. That's what the world needs. Necessarily about feeling good. It's about being real. And that feels good actually, but in a whole different way of feeling good. Everything has its proper order.
Along with this, but I met a gentleman out in Boulder when I was at dances one time who knows you. He's a high Sufi order out there, an older man.
Okay.
And he evidently has this ability and he had been hired to go in to assist with childbirth, and he did fine until he went in for his with his own daughter, he said, and then the pain was too great.
You see, but the objective here, and this is what I'm always talking about, knowing the natural rhythm of one's breath, we talked about in that previous session, I go over and over again, I keep saying you must be very stable, you must have your roots very deep, because that, in a way, is if you really are answering our dharmic purpose, every single person is responsible. And it's not personal.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's not personal. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are these talks of how Anayat Khan, he'd be talking and all of a sudden he would stop. And people could tell he was filled with great emotion. And there was something that had happened somewhere in the world that he experienced in that moment. Now, why did he stop? Was it because he couldn't go on? Or was it because he was offering a prayer?
Mm-hmm.
Someone told me, it was one of Murshid Sam's students. Maybe it was Mansoor Johnson? He wasn't here though, maybe in New Mexico or something. But he was driving, I think it was him or Wally Ollie. They were driving, and there was a terrible accident that they came upon. And whoever was driving Murshid Sam said, should we stop and pray? And he said, no, we need to keep going and we need to pray. He said, we don't need to become fixated on the impression. It does those people no good. This is what I mean when we're doing this. Is someone feeling bad? It makes that impression very deep in them that they're pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't uplift them. It's all interconnected. It may seem like I'm talking to you in fabrics, fragments, but it's all interconnected. I hope you can see that.
When my son was really young, he was only saying words at the time, and then there was a little girl that was 9 months older than him, who her verbal, she was saying complete sentences, you know, and she came out to visit one day, she and her mother, and I was aware how my son still had this ability to communicate with us,
mm-hmm.
and Autumn had lost that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just went, oh, I don't want him to learn to talk. You know, because it felt like there's part of us that are born with these abilities, and then we get socialized into this world. And they go, psh. And then maybe we come back at some point in our lives and decide we want to reconnect again.
It's interesting because I think that's why it's so good. I always tell my college students, go somewhere where you don't know the language and see how you can function.
Right.
Because then you learn to communicate in a whole different way.
No. When he was 4, we lived in Costa Rica. He did not speak a word of Spanish. These two little boys did not speak a word of English. They'd go outside and play together all day long.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be, and they just did fine. Mm. You know, they didn't fight. They just played with each other all day.
Yeah. Yeah. I was in Morocco last summer. I was in I was with that Fulbright group, and it was sometimes very challenging to be with the group, and I really had my saturation point. I needed some time away from them. And so we'd come upon a place, and the group was there, and people were busy doing things. And I said, I just need to get away, and I really needed water, and it was so unbelievably hot and, you know, oppressive. So I walked, and it was a very little village, so there wasn't much bottled water there. I maybe have told you this story, for some of you maybe have heard it, and there was this cafe where I could kind of see this cooler, you know, it was like an oasis there in the desert, and it it was, you know, when you have these moments, everything becomes very, very crystal clear in your memory. And I remember walking up these stairs to the counter and, you know, smiling and asking for the bottle of water. And I remember I had the bottle of water and I turned to go down the stairs, and there was a woman standing there. Did I tell you all this story? And she was very short, and she had this dark skin that looked like brick. And she had on, you know, the jalaba, the traditional, and it was aqua, bright aqua blue. And she had one eye that went that way and one eye that went that way. And, you know, they say sometimes people that do this, they kind of have oracular tendencies. Well, anyway, she wasn't looking at me with either one of her eyes, but I knew she was looking at me. And I just turned around, and she was just looking at me, and I was looking at her. And I just walked down the stairs, and she started to walk towards me, and we just stood there. And all these people came around us, and she reached up, and she grabbed me, and I bent down. And she went, I counted 15 times. I quit counting at 15. She kept kissing me. Just kissing. And then we looked at each other, and then she kissed the other side, and then she just, and we just kind of bowed, and then we just turned around. But that, there didn't need to be anything else, but it was a great blessing. You know, and the women in general, you know, they were veiled, but they all communicated, you know, with their eyes, and they were very, of course, very curious, you know, and we just would connect that way, just with the eyes, but that was the most outward. But another just quick funny story, and we'll get on, but this will kind of bring us back down, but I was in a place that's kind of like their Walmart. It's called Mar James. And I wanted to look for some flip-flops, you know, because they're, everybody wears sandals. And I was on the aisle with these flip-flops. There wasn't anyone there. And the next minute, it was full. All these women, they were so curious. They wanted to, you know, we were shopping together. It was so wonderful, you know. And I love the carts there, because Morocco, everything's like India. It's just moving like this. And the carts, they go this way and this way both. And so you can just, like, you know, it's kind of has to be like a dance around all the people, because there's like bunches of people that are coalescing in that, you know, the aisles and talking. And then if you don't, like, go with the, it's real interesting. You have to get in the rhythm, or otherwise you're there and you're waiting. But if you go with the flow, you can just kind of move your cart around, and it's like, it's total. I used to love to go to Mar James just to kind of have that, see what my, check my rhythm. To see if I could tune to the rhythm of the people there, and I could just keep moving. Otherwise, I'd have to stop, you know, and wait. And then it was a great experience. So these are things that, you know, shopping at Mar James can even be like, check your rhythm, you know, check your breath, see where you're at. If you're in a hurry, you know, if you're worried, or can you just like tune to the rhythm of the people? It's very interesting. Anyway, we're here till early tomorrow morning. So if anyone has any questions, check in. You can always contact me by email. May the blessings of God rest upon you. May God's peace abide with you. May God's presence illuminate your hearts now and forevermore. Thank you for your attention and your questions. I hope it was a benefit. It may have benefited.